From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Terminator 3, The Rise of the Machines, has opened in theaters this month, but visions of a cyborg future are only one facet of technology's long envelopment of humankind, says our guest tonight, science historian Edward Tenner. In his popular first book, Why Things Bite Back, Tenner explored the darker side of technology's unpredictability. In his new book, Our Own Devices, he looks at body technology and the evolving and surprising relationships between humans and their most intimate technologies, and how simple technologies shape the most intimate human behavior. What technologies do you feel closest to, most fused with? And is the future in tech-human fusion, or in a return to body simplicity? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Princeton, New Jersey, is Edward Tenner, researcher at Princeton University and at the Lemelson Center for the Study of Invention and Innovation at the National Museum of American History at the Smithsonian Institution. His new book is Our Own Devices, The Past and Future of Body Technology. Good evening and welcome, Edward Tenner.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for joining us. Wow, what a fascinating book. Edward Tenner, once again, you dive in and show us all kinds of aspects of technology's impact on human life that do not leap necessarily intuitively to mind. It was a great joy reading through this. But by the time we got to the end, and you were talking about this big, persistent, open question that remains, and that humans love thinking about, I wondered how your whole thesis fit together. You say the most challenging open question is whether mind, body, and machine will fuse in some radical new way over the next generation. You point out that over 50 years, enthusiasts have proclaimed the dawning of a new age of augmented humanity. But is that where we're heading, or do I read you as saying maybe we're headed back to the body disencumbered of technology?
It's possible to move in both directions. It's possible for somebody to spend their day working on some new high technology interface and then to take a yoga lesson, for example. So I don't think that the two are incompatible at all.
When people talk about body technology these days, I think their minds fly pretty quickly to the sort of sci-fi visions of implanted microchips and all the rest. That's not what you're talking about. You look at body technology as something with which humans already have very long and intimate experience.
I've focused on the devices that people have been using for a long time. And one of the points of the book is that even a lot of our most advanced technology really uses interfaces that have been there for centuries. For example, most electronic music now is composed with a keyboard that has not changed significantly in about 500 years. And one of the reasons for that is the conservatism of body skills, the fact that musicians have a certain investment mm-hmm. in learning to play keyboard instruments, and few of them, there are some, but few of them are willing to give that up to experiment with some radically new controller.
Which gives technology, in a funny way, a kind of passive power over humans. There are, of course, nightmare visions of the tech side taking over the human experience ultimately. You point out how firmly framed a lot of human life already is by technology. Where's the balance of power lie here already, Edward Tenner?
Well, we've been shaping ourselves with everyday technology for a long time. For example, if you compare the foot of somebody who has grown up in a society where people don't wear shoes with the foot of somebody in a so-called civilized nation, there is no comparison. The foot of the so-called primitive person is much healthier. It can grasp things. It really is not to our aesthetic taste because it's so broad, but it is really a better and more functional foot.
So does that mean that the shoe-wearing world has followed technology down on a kind of irrational path, down a blind alley? What do you take from that?
Well, there are some very positive things about wearing shoes, and I'm not suggesting that we all go barefoot all the time. In fact, there was a campaign by John D. Rockefeller to promote the use of shoes in the South because there was a high rate of hookworm because so many children were going barefoot. And some Southerners believe that this was a plot by Rockefeller, who was about to buy into the shoe industry.
picture John Dee in his top hat and morning coat without shoes.
That's true. But it's really an illustration of the dependence on shoes. Once we build cities, once we get into a certain kind of society, we need some kind of footwear. We need protection. And the question is, what is the healthiest compromise? A lot of the shoes that you see in a Sears Roebuck catalog, for example, from the late 19th century, men's as well as women's, are exceedingly thin, amazingly thin, almost grotesquely so.
As a fashion statement, almost like the cinched waistline with the corset.
Yes, and it was so much so that you could find in the same catalogs pages and pages of corn and bunion remedies. The two went together.
I have the idea that some listeners will be thinking, well, shoes, what kind of technology is that? We want to hear about gene splicing and microprocessors behind our ears. But you count shoes and other quite simple artifacts, indeed, as technology and as shaping the sort of technology envelope of human life.
Shoes are incredibly important as technology. To give you an example of how important they are, the machinery for making microchips, the mechanical part of it, is really derived from one of the machines developed by Boston's United Shoe Machinery Company for shoe manufacture. And the largest single gift to Harvard University, at least through 1949, and the one that still supports a large part of the computer science department at Harvard, was from Gordon McKay, who was an inventor and industrialist who developed one of the most influential shoe machines of the time and helped to form United Shoe Machinery Company.
So it produces a lot of money, but as I read you, Edward Tenner, it's really much more than that. You describe the very experience of human life as being framed, cosseted, certainly framed by these technologies. You look at a number of very familiar such technologies in the book, eyeglasses among them, and say, hey, not only is this a technology that has shaped human life, but it's also changed the human body.
Well, people do sometimes actually walk differently as a result of wearing glasses. Certainly, for example, Franklin Roosevelt's habit of looking down his nose was really partly due to the style of glasses that he wore. But there was an interesting relationship between eyeglasses, technology, and literacy. And in the book, I look at a debate that is now largely forgotten but was very, very vivid in medical circles in the late 19th century about the increasing prevalence of myopia. Because just as the shoes, the feet of people who grow up without shoes are healthier, so the eyesight of peasants, for example, in remote areas of Germany, according to the doctor who studied them, were much sharper than those of city dwellers. This was the time, of course, when Germany was taking the lead in mass education. So no sooner do you get all the kids in the classroom than there's a new demand for reform. All this reading is ruining their eyes. And so you had a fascinating debate at the time. On one hand, there were the reformers who said the rate of myopia is now unacceptable. But there were many other eye doctors who took a different point of view. They said, well, we're living in a society of increased demands for reading and working with precision machinery. So mild myopia is a Darwinian adaptation. In moderation, it's not so bad, and you can correct it with glasses.
And there, the technology and the behavior that results from it shapes human life. You look at the chair, the simple chair, and say, here we have a technology shaping the way we use it and ultimately our physical capacities.
Well, sure. I think the chair has probably been the most dramatic and influential of all the body technologies. The chair is something that spread from the Mediterranean all around the world to people who had been doing very, very well living at mat level. And once people started sitting in chairs and a society started going to school in chairs, working in offices and factories in chairs, it was very hard to resist the spread of the chair. And yet you can have an advanced industrial society working very, very well at mat level. You don't really need chairs for it.
So is this a loss to your mind, Edward Tenner? Is it a gain? How do you interpret the fact that it changes the way people position themselves on the planet?
Well, it is a loss in the sense that we have lost many of the traditional sitting and squatting positions. There were hundreds and hundreds of them described by Gordon Hughes in a Scientific American Review article in 1957. It was very, very striking. We have lost part of our physical heritage, and there were many beautiful positions, many customs. It's part of a kind of homogenization of the world. But the big problem of the chair is not just that it replaced other seating positions, but that the chair puts a heavier load on the spine. So chair sitting has contributed to an increase in all kinds of spinal problems, sciatica. It also is thought to lead to digestive problems. It's not a very healthy thing.
So out of all this, you pull the notion that technology, as appealing as it may be, it puts human beings on a kind of treadmill of its own creation, but of its own substance. Are humans on balance better off on that technology treadmill or not?
If you look at mortality statistics and other measures of human well-being, you could say that although hunter-gatherers probably had it best of all, if you compare the lives of people today with people in earlier agricultural societies, for example, we have definitely improved things through technology. And technology can also remedy some of the problems, for example, of chairs. There are all kinds of experimental chairs that let people relax, they let people change their positions, mm-hmm. they encourage reclining. One of the amusing things I found, though, was that one of the key inventors of reclining chairs, a Hungarian named Anton Lorenz, thought of his design, which became the basis of the Barca Lounger, as a health chair. He thought that people would come home, and after a stressful day at the office, they would rest for 15 minutes or take a nap for half an hour and then get up refreshed. Mm. And he even sponsored some of the first experiments in human weightlessness in 1938 at a German research institute to show that the position of his chair was very close to the one that the body assumed when floating in a tank of salt water.
Little did he imagine 200 million people all reclining, eating potato chips and turning into recliner potatoes.
That's exactly right. And that illustrates this power of the unintended. An inventor may have a certain model of human behavior, may think that, well, people are going to do this with my idea or do that with my idea. But what society finally does very often is 180 degrees different.
So when you look ahead at the kind of visions of future human technology fusion that are so widely imagined, do you think it's likely to turn out as people foresee, sort of computer augmented minds and vision and perhaps even speed?
I thought about that for quite a while when I was writing the book, and I came to the conclusion that probably there would be some very important change that all of this research would lead to. But I had no idea of what it would be because it really could emerge only once things were out there and people had a chance to get their hands on them and play around with them, sometimes to change what they're doing.
Because people just don't use technologies in the way very often that the inventors predict. Edward Tenner, stand by. We have to take a short break. We're going to follow this thread. We're talking tonight with Edward Tenner, author of the new book, Our Own Devices, The Past and Future of Body Technology. We're looking at technology and the human body, where they've been, where they're headed. You can join the conversation. Are we already cyborgs integrated with all kinds of technology in ways we don't give a second thought? We're at 1-800-423-2255. 800-800-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about technology and the human body, where they've been together, where they're headed. My guest tonight, joining us from Princeton, New Jersey, is Edward Tenner, Princeton researcher and author of the new book, Our Own Devices, The Past and Future of Body Technology. You can join the conversation. What technologies do you feel closest to, most fused with? Your cell phone, your BlackBerry, your shoes? Is the human body already melded with technology? And is the future in tech-human fusion or in a return to body simplicity? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Kevin is calling from Harvard, Massachusetts. Hi, Kevin. You're on the air.
Hi. I wanted to take the conversation in a slightly different direction because it's something I've been curious about for a long time, and your guest might be able to shed a little light on it.
All right, try us.
I've always wondered about the stoic personality who kind of, you know, sucks it up and lives through pain, mm-hmm. and whether it's medical pain, cancer, disease, and folks who give in a little earlier for technical innovation and going to see a doctor for whatever things can fix them, antibiotics, chemotherapy, radiation, whatever, and I'm kind of curious about that connection between the human, the element of human species that kind of like toughs it out through the hard times, whether it's good form or not, and technical innovation that could improve the short term elements of their life, but may or may not actually contribute to the long term aspect.
Yeah, there's a good loaded question, Kevin. Edward Tenner, what about it? Technology, pain, human stoicism. Have you looked at that? Have you thought about it? Is something lost? You know, the reigning notion is, let's treat pain. Let's not leave people in pain. Is something lost in that?
Well, there are really two sides of that. One is that sometimes when somebody is going for medical treatment, there can be a lot of pain associated with the treatment and getting cured. So they may have to be a greater stoic to get treated in some cases.
That part you learn later once you're in the hospital bed strapped in.
But there are also cultural differences, even, for example, within sports. I was talking with a trainer who had experience with athletes in many sports around here, and he was telling me about how different football players and competitive runners are. The runners are very sensitive to things, and they'll go to the trainer or they'll go to the team doctor. Mm-hmm. And in football, there is a tendency to play with pain, and there is a much more macho culture in the sport, but that has worked to the detriment long term of many football players because there is a very high rate of many chronic conditions among players. And an unfortunate part of a lot of sports medicine is its ability to suppress pain, keep players in the game, but thereby perhaps damage their health in the long run.
What about the notion that Kevin raises of a long term kind of median pain threshold? Has technology lowered it? Are human beings more thin-skinned? Or does the body have a kind of constant pain alert system, in your view, that over millennia?
That's hard to study scientifically, because how can you really measure it? Yep. But I think probably that people now are much more ready to go to a doctor, for example, for a pain-killing drug. I think that that a lot of people just had to live with pain. But there's another negative side of that, and that is, and it was raised by a Harvard professor of psychiatry named Arthur Barsky some years ago, that the availability of medical treatment can get people to focus on their pain and to become preoccupied with it and to go from one doctor to another, so their pain then actually becomes more painful to them.
Because they have the hope of relieving it.
That's right. And so their One of the things that psychologists do, for example, with people who have some kinds of things that can't be cured, is to lead their attention away from it, to get them to focus on other things. And the interesting thing is that once they're focusing, then the pain doesn't really matter very much to them.
Edward Tenner, stand by if you'd be good enough. I want to welcome into our conversation Sandy Pentland. He's joining us from Lexington, Massachusetts. He's director of the MIT Media Lab's Human Design Research Group. Good evening and welcome, Sandy Pentland.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Thanks for joining us. Sandy, we've got Edward Tenner on tonight looking at this big picture, as he describes it, the most challenging open question of whether mind, body, and machine fuse in some radical new way over the next generation or not. As we understand what you do at the Human Design Research Group, that's somehow a piece of it. Edward Tenner says, beware, you never know how technologies used to integrate and get close to the human body are actually going to be used. What are you working on that might fall in that category, and what are you expecting in terms of future fusion, whether it will look more or less like the fusions Edward Tenner describes in the present and past?
Well, I think he's exactly right about you never know what you're going to get, which is why I decided that somebody ought to begin thinking about it and started this group to begin looking at how do people react to this, how does the social grouping, how do the personality, the emotional, the family ties change when you add all these new technologies in. But rather than simply warning the people about it, we take an inventive stance where we're trying to build things that will actually help, or based on how we see people using them and inventing them, trying to support the good and suppress the bad.
Give us a couple of examples so
we
can think concretely.
Some of the things that, for instance, we're building now, we're building some devices that let you know about your body function much better than you're normally able to. Some people are sensitive to this, but most people aren't.
And it means a heart rate or what?
Heart rate, your internal chemistry, whether you need to drink more water. For instance, my wife often forgets to drink water and somehow can't tell that she ought to, and that gets her in trouble sometimes.
So we might have a patch or something in our clothes that would give us a kind of a spreadsheet on body function?
Yeah, something built into the clothes that feeds back to you the fact that something's a little different. Another example of that is an increasingly important problem in our society of elder care, where you have aging parents that maybe have some memory problems, maybe some behavioral problems, some chemical problems. And really what you'd like to know is that everything's okay and they're not changing in some way. They're not forgetting to eat or forgetting to take their pills. And and if you can notice something like that, for instance, if they have a little piece of jewelry that keeps track of their patterns, and if something begins to go wrong, it just encourages the family, for instance, to call more often.
So this is a lot different than help, I've fallen, I can't get up. This is a remote kind of body feedback panel.
It's a remote kind of thing, but also you have to present. This is why it's interesting to get into, is because one of the major things that's wrong with help, I'm fallen, is that it's embarrassing to people. It takes away their dignity. What you want to have something is that fits within the lines of the family and respects the dignity. So, you know, if the family calls once in a while anyhow, you can begin giving them little prompts to do that. And if something's changing, you can make those prompts a little bit more insistent. And nobody has to know anything's wrong. So there's no embarrassment of admitting that something's changed, but it becomes far more likely that you'll discover a solution through the family.
Edward Tenner, here's fresh grist for your mill. You've looked at a lot of simple technologies. Here Sandy Pentland is looking out, and I'm sure they have many projects, but one, a kind of a body feedback panel. I'm sure your mind is worrying on that. What first thoughts about how it might be adopted or used, Edward Tenner?
Well, feedback like that is a very interesting thing, because we are in a society where things are being monitored all the time. It's really a cultural thing. I can't really speak to the actual medical conditions where that is important.
But it would really just be the fact of the feedback, I suppose, that would catch your eye.
Well, the fact catches my eye, but something else does too, and that is that a big category of what I discussed in Why Things Bite Back is the false positive, the false alarm. And one of the problems that can come with any monitoring system is that it gives you a series of reports, some of which are clear warning signals, but more often than not, you get a lot of ambiguous information. And this is true, for example, in a lot of security situations. It's certainly true in the home alarm business and the car alarm business, mm-hmm. that you get all of these false alarms. So what happens if somebody gets a little something that's a little bit unusual, and then you start studying it, and maybe there's some kind of feedback effect, maybe psychologically, when you're getting these signals, they may in some way affect your physiology and the way that you can't really determine ahead of time.
So kind of too much information cycle here. Possibly.
That's what I would look out for, yes.
Sandy Pendleton, have you thought of that? Are people going to look down at their arm patch and panic?
Well, that's exactly why you don't do information in a conscious way like that, and you don't do warnings. The sort of general mm-hmm. principle is if you have a piece of technology that produces a warning, you've probably done something very bad.
Right.
The part that's interesting in what I just described, actually, is not so much the additional information, but that what I was describing, that what would happen with that information is it would reinforce an existing human network, in this case the family, mm-hmm. so that the existing sort of encouragement to call and talk would be slowly turned up as things got out of whack.
Right.
And the false positive there is, well, your son calls you more often. This is not so bad.
Sure.
and that's the art of trying to find how technology and particularly human networks work together. Earlier in the show, you talked about how things might evolve. And one of the things I noticed is that the discussion was mostly about individual objects and individual people. But there's a probably even larger thing, which is when people discovered how to plant corn and things like that, that was good. That helped. There were some ups and downs about it. But one of the things that happened a millennia or two later is they began to invent systems of farming, and that's where you got the city-state, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing with the Industrial Revolution. Steam engine helped a little bit, the weaving mills okay, but then all of a sudden you got the modern corporation and the multinational corporation, and I think people could talk a lot about the pluses and minuses of that.
So are you looking then at the internet and networking rather than individual sort of computer enhancements to a body?
Yeah, so instead of thinking about how this sort of enhancement of the individual is going to change the individual, you might look at the social effects of it. And as an example, just let me mention one time I was mm-hmm. in Finland watching young kids, high schoolers basically, talking to each other, and at the same time they were SMS messaging each other madly with their telephones.
Finland, one of the crown countries of the cell phone.
That's right. So these kids had sort of a hyper-conversation, an electronic conversation going on about the real conversation at the same time. It's sort of interesting to think about where that can go, both good and bad.
Yeah. I want to turn to our callers. We're talking tonight about technology and the human body. Are we already cyborgs of a sort, integrated with all kinds of technology in ways we don't give a second thought? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Abby's calling from Boston. Hi, Abby. You're on the air.
Hi. I grew up in Tabriz, Iran.
In Iran, okay.
Yeah, a fairly big city like Boston, but we always sat on the floor to do anything.
Okay.
We had extra room that sometimes we entertained the guests with the chair, but even our parties, most of the time, was on the floor.
And that was your tradition? That was completely natural, and now you've spent some time in the States?
Yeah, well, for about 25 years. Now when I go back, I can't even sit for 2 minutes because I kind of feel like I'm crippled. If I want to stand up, I have to walk a little bit.
So has the chair been a gift to you or a curse? How do you look at it?
I would say chair would be, well, it makes sense. With chair, blood circulation is easier. So
yeah.
I would say chair, in the case of chair, is. But, you know, I have an uncle that he still sits down, and he has no leg problem. But I remember elderly used to have problem without chair, you know.
Well, I wonder, Edward Tenner, it's exactly the thing that you brought up about the lost capacity to assume any number of reclining positions. Our caller left Iran, and 20 years later, he can't do it anymore. Has he gained something in circulation with the chair? Has he lost something? Are the Iranian relatives he left behind more likely to get a blood clot, or will their bodies have just made a lifetime specialty of reclining this way, and it's fine?
Japanese physicians actually have been debating that very question for some time, because in the younger generation of Japanese, it's also unusual to be able to hold the traditional kneeling positions for very long. And there are some doctors who feel that it's really been a great loss, and there are others who cite especially the fact that it is easier on older people who don't have to kneel, for example. Mm-hmm. So I think that the ideal might be if people alternated and retained the flexibility that they had as kids. Because when you look at kids playing and sitting, they have all of those positions that Gordon Hughes described in his review article. They can do all those things, and it's only later that we select only a few of them and we forget about the others, just as when kids are very small. They're making all of these sounds that later they have to go to great trouble to learn when they're learning foreign languages.
But maybe that's just natural. I mean, you don't find septuagenarians leaping over fences typically like children might.
No, but I think it's good if people do keep flexible and learn to try out different positions. And in fact, anthropologists who visit countries where people still live at mat level tell me that after a few months, they really can learn to live that way. It just takes some time.
So technology can bite in to that capacity. Neil's calling from Lynn, Massachusetts. Hi, Neil. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Great, thanks.
I do yoga, and I have blood clots.
Okay. Is it helping, Neil?
Well, if I don't go overboard. However, that's not my I just wanted to mention the flexibility thing that you just finished up.
Yeah, duly noted.
I want to direct my question to the MIT guy, gentleman, professor, whatever. And I want to ask him if the amount of electronic gizmos on the body, while providing an excellent benefit in terms of blood pressure, blood sugar levels, contact with the home base, may be overloading the heart that has an electrical component and causing problems in that way.
Are you talking about cell phones or something more intimately attached to the body, Neil?
Well, cell phones are at, what are they, at 900 something megahertz or whatever.
Okay, we got it. Neil, thanks for your call. Sandy Pentland, is there a risk to bringing a lot more flow of electricity around the body through gizmos and gidgets?
Well, I think that people have studied it quite a bit, and the specific thing he mentioned has, I've never heard anybody find any sort of hint of danger there. And the danger from electronic radio frequency and so forth seems to be pretty much non-existent, too. The thing that most people talk about is information overload and sort of always being on, having your pager there, having too many inputs to you. And I think that's the sort of thing that one needs to watch out for.
Too many inputs, possibly. Sandy Pentland, Edward Tenner, please stand by. We've got to take a short break. We're talking tonight about technology and the human body, where they've been, where they're headed. You can join the conversation. What tech enhancements for your body would you like that you don't already have? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about technology and the human body, where they've been, where they're headed. My guest is Edward Tenner. He's author of the new book, Our Own Devices, The Past and Future of Body Technology. And also with us tonight, Sandy Pentland, director of the MIT Media Lab's Human Design Research Group. You're welcome to join the conversation as well. What technologies do you feel closest to, most fused with? Your cell phone, your BlackBerry, your shoes. Do you want more body tech or less? And what's the future of body technology. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Elizabeth is calling from Westford, Massachusetts. Hi, Elizabeth. You're on the air.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. Good to have you.
I'm interested in hearing from both Drs. Tenner and Dr. Pentland what their study has been of the way the computer and the information revolution have been modifying our expectations of what our own minds should be able to do in terms both of processing large amounts and remembering mm-hmm. large amounts of information, and also of being able to switch our information from one, our attention from one dense information context to another very quickly, and to multitask. Because I remember a figure that in the revolutionary period, a single individual was most likely to see in an entire lifetime the amount of information that's now in a daily edition of something like the New York Times. And so we're really, I think, pushing our minds, which are after all part of our bodies, right to the limits of our ability to manage informational complexity and attention demands.
So your suspicion we hear there, Elizabeth, is that human beings are kind of aping or trying to compete with the technology they've created in the computer. Let me put it, Edward Tenner, your response.
Well, some people really do live in environments like that. If you watch pictures, for example, of people trading securities, they may have four or five screens that they're watching. Mm-hmm. What's really interesting, though, is how many people have managed to adapt and manage their information intake. So the number of journals, for example, that scientists read regularly has not increased as far as I've been able to see. What's happened is that there's more specialization and people specialize more and more, partly to manage that flow of information. So they're following the same small number of researchers in the same number of journals, except that there are more specialties to go around. But I don't doubt that there are many people who are confronted with this. However, I'd add one more thing, and that is that this was a style that was starting to grow well before the development of computers. There were complaints, for example, in the late 19th century that people had shorter attention spans. They were interested only in smaller units. I mentioned in my chapter on eyeglasses that Arthur Conan Doyle, when he failed as an ophthalmologist, developed a new business plan as a writer. And the key to it was that instead of serializing novels, he would write independent Sherlock Holmes adventures, because the public at that time already was less patient to follow a novel from one issue of a periodical to another.
So as someone who's followed technology, what's your sense of why humans in the 19th century would already have been clipping their attention span? Was it technology related? Was it the telegraph and the railroad timetable, or something cultural not born in technology?
It was speedier printing presses and cheaper composition. The late 19th century was really the great information explosion. It was a print explosion. There were no other media. So everything that we associate with other media took place either in print or on the stage.
And Sandy Pittman, let me put it to you. As we develop computers, are computers somehow setting new benchmarks for processing speed, memory, multitasking? Do you see humans trying to keep up with their creation?
Well, I think this is one of the places where people have made a great series of errors for maybe as much as a century, which is they tried to present information as a sort of a conscious literary channel, what we think of as media. Mm. On the other hand, if you look at us in terms of our memory for where we've been and what we've done, our episodic memory, we're able to hold hundreds of millions of things in our head at the same time, access them. It's completely comfortable. So one way to think about this is to begin, instead of doing this sort of all very conscious, formal type of organization of information, doing more like the memory palaces of some of the famous memnists, where information is tied to our life in a much more close way. And that's the sort of thing that we're building at MIT.
Things kind of that organic associations.
Augmented memories that are tied to the parts of your life in a way where you can say, oh, I remember I was talking to Bill in the restaurant, and then that's available to you. But you don't have to expend your mental energy to try and drag it up other ways.
That's fascinating. Edward Tenner, I was struck by one observation you make in the book, Our Own Devices, at your sense that the human body is fundamentally conservative somehow, that it's not eager to be run away with by technologies. It's almost resistant, as I read you.
That's my way of saying that people have a certain investment in skills. And whenever you've invested a lot in something, you're always going to favor a solution that lets you conserve and use your investment rather than write it off and buy another very expensive solution. I don't think of that as bad, but I do think it would be nice, for example, to have more new sounds that are playable by new controllers. But it is still a fact that we look for new things that will let us build on what we have already been doing.
But maybe resistant to that new video cassette recorder. Kate's calling from Viroqua, Wisconsin. Hi, Kate. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Great, thanks.
Good. My question was in regards to the former comment where, you know, people are so concerned about, like, what is the situation with, you know, overloading as far as cell phones, computers, et cetera, mm-hmm. et cetera, and how does that cause a stress factor?
Mm-hmm.
But in regards to the other fact that, you know, these people that are in these other countries that, you know, obviously third world are dealing with, I think, a greater stress factor in regards to where is their food coming from, where is their shelter, what happens if the rain doesn't come for, you know, crops, et cetera.
No shortage of big stress factors there
absolutely.
Either.
Absolutely. And so, you know, I personally would love to say, oh, you know, the technology part is not great. But, you know, that is a huge, you know, consideration. Like, okay, so you have these other factors for these people having stress in
regards right, to, just different kinds of stress.
Know.
Let me put
Absolutely.
Our time's going down. But, Kate, thanks for your call. Edward Tenner, how about it? Is it possible to measure one against another the kinds of stress of the fast-paced, contemporary, developed world lifestyle versus the less developed and what we think of as slower paced, but is the stress level different in humans?
I think it really depends on the resources of a community. To take one case, if you have a hunter-gatherer population, a small population surrounded by rich resources, that's going to be a very, very low-stress society. But if you have an agricultural society, especially with a drought, or if you have overpopulation, that's going to be extremely stressful. And the same thing is true in industrial societies. They can be very stressful if lots of jobs are being cut, or if there is prosperity, lots of competition for employees, there can be a very different feeling.
So good times are good and bad times are bad. Sandy Pentland, just a final thought. This cyborg future that you know many people imagine, is it out there or is it likely to be nothing like that? Sort of.
I think we're already there to a large extent. And what's incumbent on us is to make it a positive experience. And I think we'll be able to. I think we'll use that as a way to bond together our families more tightly and making our work groups a little more pleasant as well as efficient.
So not Terminator 3 is out there punching each other, but somehow networked, social networks brought together by technology.
That's right. Social networks brought together.
Wow. It's a great vision, and we thank you for sharing it with us tonight. Sandy Pentland, thanks so much for coming on.
My pleasure.
Sandy Pentland is director of the MIT Media Lab's Human Design Research Group. And Edward Tenner, your thought on that. Do you have the equal confidence that we'll avoid the kind of dark robot future and integrate technologies in a way that, as Sandy says, brings people together?
The only confidence that I have is that we're going to have surprises. And the surprises are not going to be the ones we expect. The positive things are not going to be the positive things we expect. The negative ones aren't going to be the negative. You can find out a little more, by the way, on my website, www.edwardtenner.com, where I have some further speculation about the past and the future.
And you can find out a great deal more in Edward Tenner's new book, Our Own Devices, The Past and Future of Body Technology. Really fascinating. Look, Edward Tenner, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you very much.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Just click on forums. In a moment, a tribute to jazz legend Benny Carter. This is On Point. The world of music lost a giant over the weekend with the passing of jazz saxophonist and composer Benny Carter. Carter's career was extraordinary not only for its influence but for its length. His 1920s big band compositions ushered in the swing era, and he continued to perform and compose well past his 90th birthday. While his modesty kept him from achieving the popularity of a Louis Armstrong, he was so revered among his peers that they simply called him King. The New Yorker magazine once wrote that Carter belongs to that select circle of pure jazz musicians who tend to represent the best of their times. Benny Carter died on Saturday in Los Angeles. He was 95. Ed Berger was a longtime friend and associate of Carter's. He produced most of Carter's recordings over the past 20 years and is the co-author of Benny Carter, A Life in American Music. In this On Point tribute, Ed Berger reflects on what made Benny Carter one of the all-time greats of jazz.
Aside from his longevity, I think it was the fact that he was made such a vital contribution in so many areas of the music, and that in every area, if that was the only thing he had done, he would have left his mark. But he did it as an instrumentalist, and not just as a saxophonist. He also was a highly accomplished and original-sounding trumpet player, and he was quite accomplished on clarinet also, although he gave up the instrument in the 40s, and he recorded quite proficiently on several other instruments from time to time. But apart from his work as an instrumentalist and really one of the pace setters on alto saxophone beginning in the 20s, he was also one of the prime architects of the big band sound and the whole swing era because of his arranging abilities and his compositions. Never a showman. I mean, he had a great stage presence, and he was entertaining and very good with an audience, but he never had what you'd call a shtick, and he was pretty straightforward and well-spoken, and he refused to do some of the more gimmickry aspects of it that various managers and agents would have liked to see him do. And his bands were very musical, very professional, and for that reason, he never really... He had some, you know, I won't say he was unknown. I mean, he led a major big band throughout the late 30s and mid-40s and certainly got a lot of press. But as people have pointed out, his reputation among musicians and critics far exceeded his popularity with the general public. Benny was an extremely complex person. There are many adjectives that are often bandied about, you know, his modesty, his sophistication, the word urbane is often used, and all of these things are true, but I don't think they really get at the complexity of the man, and I'm not sure anyone really knew how deep he truly was, but he certainly was all of the things people write about him. He was very self-effacing. I many times attempted to interview him in the course of researching our biography of him. And, you know, it was painful, frankly, because he would deflect any question about himself or any attempt to attribute, you know, some accomplishment to him. He would modestly say, well, I don't know if I did that, but have you heard so-and-so, you know, how wonderful he was? And he would talk about, in very articulate terms, about almost anything and anybody except himself. If he had only worked in one of these many areas that he was active in, he would have left his mark. But I don't think anybody really did so many things in so many areas so well for so long.
Ed Berger is Associate Director of the Institute of Jazz Studies at Rutgers University and co-author of Benny Carter, A Life in American Music. Benny Carter died on Saturday. He was 95. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.